Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, you're listening to SupDoc. I'm Parker Romaine.
And I'm George Chen. And this is a show where we talk to interesting people with strong opinions about their favorite documentaries.
And on today's episode, we review Buster Keaton Rides Again, the 1966 documentary from directors John Spotton and Gerald Potterton.
Buster Keaton Rides Again is a behind-the-scenes filming of one of Buster Keaton's very last short comedies, The Rail Rider, which features him in a rambling train tour across Canada.
And we chat with comedian, actor, musician, and proud Canadian Nick Flanagan.
Welcome to the Glendale Palace.
Glendale Boulevard.
Nick Flanagan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Nick.
Hello. Hi, guys.
When you've moved people
George
into
Paco.
This building before.
Not this building, but
into
this very
room.
This a very
home.
Future guest slash roommate of Paco. Yeah.
How did you and like when, 2.5 years ago,
yeah, it was
you had
when
no
I was
idea
here.
That you would be sitting here with not the person you moved in.
Right. Yeah. I presumed 2.5 years ago, I'm going to be here in 2.5 years with the person I moved in. And in fact, the opposite happened. I am not here with the person who did not.
This is so deep for insider.
I don't
info.
Even know.
But you weren't even living here, and you just were like, "Hey, I'll help you move stuff in." Did you drive out?
I do long. Yeah. I was before I came here in January. I've done long stints. Mm-hmm. So I was probably here, cat sitting for my friend, in like late October 2013, and that was probably when I did this.
So you know these cats.
I've met these cats before.
Mosby and Millie.
Hi, Mosby. Hi, Millie.
Yeah.
Mosby's got
and
a good
you're
move.
Let's so let's back up yeah, a sec. Yeah. You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada. Home of the Whopper.
Is it the home of the
also home of the Whopper?
Also home of the Whopper.
We have the
yeah.
Burger King franchise
and the Raptors.
As well. And the Raptors.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, people laughed when they named them the Raptors. They said, "Oh, great, you're naming it after this cultural phenomenon. No one's going to remember." Well, 5 movies. No championships later.
Yeah.
Is that team from
Who's
the
laughing
90s? I don't know, the Raptors.
They're good. They're better than ever. That's
yeah,
the best way to describe it.
Probably the best
Raptors.
They've ever been.
Yeah.
And did you grow up, so you're not, are you from Toronto?
Yeah.
You grew up in Toronto.
Grew up in Toronto. I've never lived in any other city.
Until
besides.
Now.
Yes, until Los Angeles.
Are we going to be blowing up your spot for immigration if we talk about your status right now?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I need. I sort of need residency status in Canada, so.
I'm sure they're listening to this podcast. All of the major authority figures, TSA.
Oh, man.
And, yeah. NSA,
Hillary Clinton has actually written on our iTunes review.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She was just like, she said, what up? Paco and George, vote for me in November.
I'm with her.
Yeah, and then she wrote,
I'm with her.
Yeah. That's how it's not sad. I'm with her, it's I'm with her.
I'm with her.
Yeah,
and
so
you did,
signed,
did you start doing comedy and music in Toronto?
Yeah, definitely. I started being in bands when I was like a teenager, and then...
First band name, that's always a good one.
Head Cleaner.
Okay, not bad.
Yeah,
nice.
I think so.
I know a band called CCR Head Cleaner.
Okay,
yeah.
That's funny.
CCR Head Cleaner?
Yeah, it's like John Fogerty's Head Cleaner, you know?
That's funny. What was your first band's name, George?
First band that I was in high school was called Suspicious Characters.
I like that a lot. That sounds like...
Not my name.
Sounds like hardcore.
Yeah, someone else's band, I just sat in with them. Suspicious Characters. Worst band name ever that I was involved in, Sanitary Gremlins.
Ugh. Jesus.
Sanitary Gremlins?
Yeah.
That's a horrible
name.
That's
a bad one. I think I've had a lot of close calls with band names. I can't even... Thing is, if you were naming bands in the 90s...
Yeah.
you actually can't legally say half of your potential band names in 2016 because of, at that time, ironic use of racial slurs and stereotypes was rampant.
Only in Sexism. Toronto, man. Not everywhere else.
Maybe not at Gilman. Maybe not if you were in the Bay Area.
No,
but it was so debated that you for sure had people doing that just to be dicks.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about your buddy heads. I'm talking about...
Oh, right, yeah, yeah.
You know, that was happening.
The Australian band The Cunts, very popular right now. Yeah.
And there was even this clear internal struggle between sort of just jump... immediately into like
hardcore arcana. That's our audience.
Yes, exactly. If we're gonna get in, this is how we're gonna do it.
Yeah.
Flipside and MRR, especially Flipside, had a real bent for like misanthropic stuff within the PC stuff. You know, Flipside had it in general. Because it was a bit more just like alt culture.
Right.
Maybe because it actually even looked a bit like a Sessions magazine from Alternative Press. But MRR, I feel like the people who are misanthropic were like 10 times more than anywhere else. They were really like, screw you, agents of like Reverend Norb and Michael Board too.
You know?
It's all a blur. And I mean, it was.
Remember when MRR mattered? Like,
I love that I'm like,
now?
It's all a blur. I'm saying it's all a blur and then I'm just. Pinpointing specific
like,
things.
Like
about.
When they gave me a bad review in 1998.
I remember reading like the recap of Gigi Allen's like last show in MRR. I remember reading his letters from jail that he sent to MRR where they published them,
oh my
you
God.
Know?
What? Are you a Gigi Allen fan ever?
No. No, God, no.
Is there a good talk about Gigi?
Yeah, well, Hated was the reason, was what basically pushed him into... Well, he was always in the mainstream because he was doing what he was doing was so specific, and it somehow wasn't
it's
like
very specific.
Yeah, but you know, like you have the sort of people who are like that, like anti-scene or the mentors, and Gigi was like somehow more and less cartoonish at the same time than those groups, and he was on Springer, and everyone remembered it.
Right.
He was on. Morton Downey, maybe I don't know if he was on Morton Downey Jr., but
Donahue or something.
Donahue
like that,
and Todd Phillips directed Hated, which is like basically about him. And
what else did Todd Phillips do?
He directed all the Road Trip, all the Hangover movies.
That's the same guy.
And
oh, he
did
started.
He started making basically like voyeuristic, like zeitgeist, almost underground at that time because there was no internet. So, like, he made that frat movie, and people were like, have you seen that documentary about frats? It's fucked.
Oh, and no, I haven't seen
it. I still haven't seen it.
We got to do that
Frat
one.
House, I don't remember what it's called. And then Hated definitely was a mainstay at, you know, video stores and subcultural ones. But Gigi Allen, it goes so much deeper with Gigi Allen because when he started in the late 70s, early 80s, right? And that stuff he did in Boston is actually good.
Yeah.
You know, like he had these sort of periods of good stuff and he kind of did
street punk kind of
street punk stuff, but he also did this crummy thing where they would like some of the songs that are good from that period are just like weird redos of like punk hits of the time, you know? So if you want to hear Scumfuck Tradition, I can get so deep.
I love how we're
G.
getting
Allen
it like
too.
From Gigi Allen. We have to make a transition now from Gigi Allen.
I was
to
just
Buster
about
King.
To. So I'm going to ask you, who is the most punk rock of the early.
Oh, good question.
Yeah, the early black and white comedians.
Was Chaplin the Ian MacKay of early silent
films? That's
film.
So funny. That's like, there is definitely something with like. Where you're kind of like, well, Chaplin's DC, and Buster Keaton is kind of like
West
he's,
Coast.
I would say he's LA hardcore, you know, like because he was really addicted, you know, he had a lot of addictions, and he was, I think from my very limited exposure to all of that stuff, which is generally one or two movies per person, and I think primarily Chaplin and Buster Keaton, so I can't even weigh in on Harold Lloyd. I would say that Buster Keaton is undoubtedly
the black flag.
No, he's like the weirdos.
The weirdos.
because
well, Harold Lloyd's even more obscure. Like Harold Lloyd is like,
but he was he
I
was
mean, none
huge.
Of these guys are obscure though.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, but
I mean you're right, but it's like they're all lost.
Yeah.
Because they're all almost 100 years old, which yeah. is insane to think.
Or
of.
Exactly 100, like yeah. 1916. I mean.
Yeah, but Harold Lloyd. I mean, to me, they all were just the building blocks of cinema, and most of them somehow deftly dodged around being so racially and culturally insensitive that it's unwatchable.
Right.
Or like the, you know, Buster Keaton. So Buster Keaton, you know, pioneered stunt work or like not set piece stunt work, like mm-hmm. not
yeah.
even,
yeah.
not even just jumping out of the way, but like actually like, you know, derailing a train.
Right.
Which, yeah. You know. And the famous move of the house, the second story window that's opened and then misses
right,
him.
Yeah.
And
basically risks his life like yeah. every time.
Every time.
Harold Lloyd, though, was like one of the first vaudevillian movie stars that did his own stunts from like ridiculous heights.
Right, yeah. Harold Lloyd was crazy with that, too.
He
yeah.
he always did his own stunts. The one where he's hanging from the clock tower
yeah.
is actually him hanging from a fucking clock
that.
Tower.
Yeah.
yeah.
I was wondering if that was like, it's... I don't know how, is it all high up? Because there's a couple scenes that are referenced in Buster Keaton that I was brought. There's a second. Okay, so the documentary we're talking about, let's go backwards.
Let's
firstly, so Nick, we always ask the guests to pick a documentary. You had your pick of the history of cinema, and you chose
an odd one.
Buster Keaton Rides Again. And some of your reasoning behind it, I think we should get into.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is your relationship to Buster Keaton and this film?
Well, my relationship to Buster Keaton comes from growing up in a house that was, there was like lots and lots of videotapes. And, you know, my dad was like, when the VHS revolution happened, you know, he was just one of these people who got obsessed with taping anything. You know, Canada had a lot of programming of mm-hmm. older films, you know, and he'd subscribe to like Film Comment and American Film, had all these books of film yeah. criticism by like Leslie Halliwell and stuff. So I was always really aware of, and was obsessed. He was also obsessed with the French New Wave, so he had all those books.
What'd your dad do for a living?
He's a postal worker, uh-huh. but also a poet, like a published poet and writer. Mm-hmm. So
you have to ask it like Marc Maron. Okay. What'd your old man do?
Who are his guys?
Who are his guys?
Who are
Gigi Allen, Buster Keaton?
Gigi Allen.
What'd your old man do?
Oh, you like Gigi? Gigi had some stuff.
El Duce. I don't get that El Duce.
I never really
guy.
Registered Gigi Allen. He never really fell in my line of eye fire.
Yeah.
Eye fire.
So your dad, big cinema buff.
So yeah, so we had all these things basically on hand mm-hmm. and also guidebooks for them. So I was pretty aware of Buster Keaton, but I couldn't really process it. I didn't really like the silent films all that much, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Like Chaplin always, I remember I watched The Great Dictator and I was a teenager and I was like, I don't know. The
yeah.
ball part's cool. And then people were like posting that speech recently
yeah.
that he gives at the end and I was like, I don't even think that much of this speech particularly. It feels like an award
yeah.
show speech.
But he gave it at a time. Yeah, it's a time and place kind of thing.
It was a time and place, but it was still not very militaristic, which you kind of needed to be about Hitler
yeah.
in 1941 because nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah.
In Germany, they didn't know it was as bad, so it reflects that. So it's contextually very interesting.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I just... And obviously, like, he did so many amazing things, and I appreciate him more now. But there was something about Buster Keaton's look that I really loved
oh, yeah.
and I preferred, where I actually thought him and Charlie Chaplin were, like, the same guy. Did you have that
a
kid?
Until yesterday, convinced that Buster Keaton did all the Harold Lloyd clock stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I got them confused for a minute.
Yeah, poor yeah. Fatty Arbuckle.
Bandit,
so is he Fear?
Yeah, leaving.
Yeah, yeah. Have you read that book, I, Fatty?
Oh, it's the greatest.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Yeah.
You guys got to fill me in on that because I didn't know. Okay, so.
It's by Jerry Stahl.
One of the yeah. things I read, in another doc about. So I watched this doc, which is only about an hour.
Yeah.
There is another doc that came up on YouTube called Hard Act to Follow.
And it was about Buster Keaton?
About Buster Keaton. And then that gets into this thing where Fatty Arbuckle was like his homie. That's
yeah.
the guy who gave
yeah.
him all his
and
stuff.
It's really likely that Fatty Arbuckle was, to some extent, innocent.
That's what he claims in that doc that came out in 85.
Because it sounds
yeah.
like it sounds like some crazy stuff happened at that party, but that Fatty Arbuckle was probably... But I don't know, because it's all within, like, Jerry Stahl's telling of it that is my version of it now, which is that he was, like, a junkie who was basically too out of it at all times.
Yeah, well, also the court case. I mean, he was...
Well, and he was found not...
He was acquitted, three, so...
There were three cases, yeah.
He was, not only was he acquitted, but he was also acquitted... It felt like that case was one where... Things were stacked against him in terms of the court of public opinion.
Yes,
right. In terms of everything. So
because of the teetotaling San Francisco, which is crazy to think about.
Right. Yeah. But
is that where it happened?
Yeah,
it was San Francisco.
It was the Saint Francis Hotel. Jesus.
Oh,
sorry.
Really?
Yeah. I've been to the room. You can go to the room.
That's cool.
The room.
But going back, it's just like I then went to. Post-secondary education, University of Toronto, for like not very long. Uh-huh. And I took a film course where they were really just showing you films. And they were all films I'd already seen.
Yeah, that's
like,
weird.
It was so annoying. And just to get into the sort of nuts and bolts of filmmaking and also of drama at this school, I thought this was so horrible that they did this. You had to take theory for a year. Before you were even in the program.
Dude, my college, they didn't even, I think they only had theory. They didn't have hands on.
Maybe this one had only theory. Yeah. So I was like reading this stuff and I was just so bored. So they showed, but they showed the general at this college screening house. And I was like really amazed. To me, I was like, to me, it was as good as anything else.
Well, Orson Welles claimed it was the greatest American film.
I mean, that was how I saw it through that prism, because it was just like, you know, at that time there was such a worship of like people like Jackie Chan or these Hong Kong movies that had crazy acrobatics.
Yeah.
And Buster Keaton was a direct progenitor of that, or whatever you would say. Like that part, isn't there the part where he's like... jumping on the back of the train, he keeps falling off and jumping back on. It's such a crazy stunt to do, you know. And so I was so impressed by him. And frankly, I've seen very little of his work other than that. I think I saw a couple of them, but, you know,
now,
The General is pretty much it.
This film, this was made by the National Film Board of Canada. Was it like something that was on TV when you were growing up?
No, not at all. I mean, this movie I only discovered probably about a year and a half ago, because I would love going to the Toronto libraries and just taking out whatever DVDs were handy and looked interesting to me. I thought I was doing like a life hack.
The library is a life hack.
Free movies.
Yeah.
You don't have
to rent. The library is a life hack.
And...
Was it paired with Rail Rodder?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was the Rail Rodder and Buster Keaton Rides Again, and it was really interesting watching them both, and it was really fascinating to me thinking about the NFB, which was this incredible sort of Canadian, just such a mixture of stuff. Like it was like a non-bad communist office of culture, you could call it, you know, like, and it presented really interesting artists and really, I think, pioneering documentary stuff here and there, or at least it was like on par with like Wiseman and Maisel's and stuff, but about weird, more boring Canadian stuff, maybe. But when I say more boring, it is mostly more subtle. So the director, John Spotten, of
Buster Keaton Resident.
Yeah, I just read today. Even though I presumed he'd been involved with it, but he had worked on as an editor on The Lonely Boy, which is another NFB thing, which is about Paul Anka when he's like 15 years old. And it shows him, young Paul Anka, you know, at the beginning of his stardom. And it's a very interesting watch. And that pairs well, even though it's not the same people, with...
Is Paul Anka Canadian?
Yeah, he's from Ottawa. Ladies and Gentlemen, Mr. Leonard Cohen, which is another really good NFB documentary. So I just thought I picked this one because it was about such an important figure who's so beaten in the documentary.
Yeah.
Like when I put that documentary on, the only time I had ever heard Buster Keaton speak was in Sunset Boulevard when he goes, you know, I'll pass. That's what he says, right? He's playing bridge with like Norma Desmond and all these people.
So he's playing himself in that.
He's basically playing himself. And it's like,
just like Topher Grace in Ocean's 11.
Right.
Same.
Or, pretty much equivalent.
Yeah. Neil Patrick Harris Harold and Kumar, yeah. And I keep thinking it's Dude, Where's My Car, but...
His voice is so deep in this. Was it? I don't remember in Sunset Boulevard if it was that same deep.
I think he has so few lines in Sunset Boulevard, you just don't notice it. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely the first thing I noticed about this documentary was like, oh my God, the most graceful presence on screen. Talks like you would expect him to, like a freaking, you know, like, probably high school dropout vaudevillian, you know,
no
like American
school.
Guy.
1 year of school, maybe. It's, I think,
but
he
seems so bright, you know. And
he's very,
And he's just like, what we used to do was we used to
fall off the horse and get back.
There's only one thing that sells the gag that a duck hunter wants lining up on his duck. I'm gonna shoot come hell or high water. So, for that camera, just missing the tunnel by 3 feet. He's just missing it. And as I come up, he pans maybe a little bit with me, but as I come into his shot, I bring my gun up to follow a flight. And when I get here, I shoot. And my gun is only about 5 feet from the tunnel when I shoot. So I've shot right into it.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's so many, and I read up on that documentary and on Buster Keaton's life after that. And to think that he had sort of 30 years of being in this wilderness of just trying to survive, that, you know, there's just all these crazy Easter eggs in that, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
Specifically, but they're like sad Easter eggs. They're not...
Oh, yeah,
like,
right, yeah, like, yeah, you were saying...
Yeah, before, I think I wrote that in the thing. Like, the saddest thing being that he's, his, like, emphysema and asthma is, like, I think it's just asthma they refer to in the movie, but it was, like, actually terminal cancer that he was not told that he had.
Oh, like...
So he was just going about his life with his, like, you know, cigarette holder.
Wait,
he wouldn't have stopped.
Well, hold up for just a second. So... Yeah. Who knew that he had terminal cancer?
I think his family. But I think his wife.
They didn't tell him?
He was not told. His doctor.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. As that far actually... as I understood, it was undisclosed.
Wow.
It was in his Wikipedia when I read it several years ago.
So
I don't know if that's fully, but that makes sense because he looks ill, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks 1960s old guy in that movie.
Well, he's like 69. He's very
he's 69.
Still
I mean, he died
spry.
He maybe died 1 or 2 years after.
Yeah, I think 66.
Yeah.
This is 64 that this shot. So he still is able to do so much physically, surprisingly.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably
70,
because it's.
Wow.
It's what was programmed, you know, into him. If he was basically like a Jackie Chan or like any of those guys who did those, like, basically illegal, should be illegal, like, tumbling schools from when you're, like, a child.
No insurance.
Know?
No studio will cover the insurance on
these
people.
It's like one of those muscular children you see around nowadays.
Muscular children?
Yeah, there's all these buff kids that are going on Maury.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is... I did a weird thing where I stopped watching this somewhere in the middle and started watching the other doc because I wanted more background. Yeah. They threw all of the background at the very end of it when they had the photos of him in the fake beard when he's like 5 years old.
You're talking
old,
about the
Buster Keaton Rides Again.
Yeah.
Right, like all the backstory for that stuff. There's a lot of allusions to backstory, but it's because they have the raw footage.
I really think that that documentary, I don't think it's like a necessarily standout documentary necessarily, except that I think that the non-archival footage is very interesting.
All of the stuff of them making the movie,
it should have just been that, in my view.
What I loved about it, I feel like if that had been made today, all the good shit that was in it would have been edited out because people would have thought it would have been boring or too inside baseball.
Yeah.
But I loved it. When they're talking about gags and how to set up shots and what's going to be funnier,
that's
the map.
Movie to me. They're just trying to contextualize it with all the other stuff.
Yeah, and that's the stuff I feel like they probably would have just cut out today.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been more of him eating dinner with friends and like that kind of weird shit that they showed.
Right.
But as a comedian and a lover of Buster Keaton and gags and bits, like for me, it was so much fun.
Sketches
and shticks and stones. But it was fun to watch.
I love stones.
Yeah, sticks and stones. That was fun for me to watch them actually like mapping out.
And also watching him kind of going back and forth with the British director.
Yeah, Poddington.
And him being like, can you do this? I don't know if you can do this. And he's like, yeah, it'll be fine.
I almost, you know, it was harder for me to put the laundry on the line. I was slipping so much. This is easy.
Yeah.
He's like, I've done harder things in my sleep.
And getting the Italian guys.
Yeah,
and when actually, I did think all of that archival stuff was really good because they were doing some interesting talking about, you know, how they would come up with a lot of the jokes, you know, in the movies, just traveling to film the movie.
Yeah.
And you start realizing all of these, like, great movies that were made in the 1930s maybe were, like, pretty on the fly, you
know?
Absolutely. Like working on their feet. Of course, in the context of that, these people have been doing the same act on vaudeville for 20 years and sort of had formulas in their head of how to make it.
Yeah. I wrote down the scenario that they say at the end of the movie, which I really loved. By age four, they let him join the theater troupe because he said he would sleep in late to his parents. Classic comedians.
Yeah.
They're like, sure, you can do it, but you have to sleep late because we're not getting up. And by five, he was applying his own makeup. By seven, he was getting clobbered on stage for mistakes. By nine, he was traveling with them, and by 11, he was writing gags.
And he was like traveling with like Houdini in the beginning. That's part of it too.
Was it him who? I always forget whether I think it was him and not Chaplin. He was the one who was like basically dodging getting punched in the face, like as his act. Like he was the person who could roll around and get hurt without getting hurt.
Well, like his dad would just throw him into like the orchestra,
like the flying
or whatever.
Chaplin or whatever.
I had read once that Buster Keaton's dad put a harness under his coat and he would pick him up by the like basically by a luggage like hand rack thing, and he would pick him up and just throw him into the scenery. And at like age four and five.
And that's like where.
No wonder he had he had such a melancholy resting face.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad.
Resting stone face.
Like PTSD at all times. And then the alcoholism is very interesting.
The father was definitely alcoholic. That was mentioned.
I mean, how is it?
It's a vaudeville.
In a world
dude,
like that, I guess you know how many of the Marx Brothers had that problem?
Mm-hmm. All of them, probably.
Mm-hmm. What's his name?
Groucho.
Groucho seemed to have it pretty together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
But still, I mean, back then, I mean, like, you know, you have a couple cocktails at lunch, you know. It's not alcoholism when you're drinking four martinis at lunch.
Right.
In the 50s. That's just lunch.
Yeah, and smoking when you have asthma, smoking when you have cancer. Yeah. That was probably, like, what was happening, you know.
It's
so crazy.
I can't believe they didn't tell him. I just looked it up in the Wikipedia page. It says that despite being diagnosed with cancer, he was never told that he was terminally ill.
Yeah, that
by his doctor or his wife.
That was what stuck with me.
And they may not even told the director, that British director Poddington. He's like, he's just worried about his physical, like, his physical, like, ability to do stuff.
I mean, I'd be interested at how that information came out after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know, like if the wife told people or. You know, obviously, while he was maybe in his final days, that was what happened. Like
I know in my family with my grandma, like because she's like also like an immigrant who didn't really speak English, and it's probably like a lot of stuff with doctors in America she just wasn't gonna get. but I don't think my family told her for sure, like,
that
what
she was ill.
I think it was just she knew she was sick, but I don't think it was like clearly to her what it was or anything like that. Not to be a total bummer about my family, but yeah, like I could see maybe back in the 60s they're just like, well, let's let him have like
have some fun,
have the fun and not know. But I mean, I can't, it's not it's not ethically, you know.
No, it's not ethically it's, right, but the way that, you know,
we're gonna go down a real dark,
this is such
dark
a
hole.
Weird road to go.
I know,
but like, I think the reality of people, like, there's this whole like thing everyone is saying, like, oh yeah, they fought so hard. It's like with cancer, it's like most of the time it goes like it just doesn't feel like I have it.
Right, you don't feel it physically,
and they're
yeah.
trying to cure me.
Yeah,
and then followed by, oh God, I'm very depressed.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm ready. Yeah. Now I'm too tired to feel good about this. So sometimes taking that sort of stages period is like, it almost sounds preferable.
Well, I mean, also watching this, it's like, it seemed like he wanted to keep working.
That was what she was saying. But she sounded like she kind of was like, had a lot. It sounds like that guy was like a lot to deal with. And I loved it when they were saying, you know, he's an acute alcoholic. And they're like, now he just has the occasional beer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're like,
and then the next shot is him drinking a beer. Like, which is, that's a wink to the audience if there ever was one. It's like the occasional beer.
That documentary also is it's actually on the, you know, it has a lot going on under the surface. That's why I enjoyed it so much, you know.
I agree. There's definitely a lot going on under there.
I learned about one thing I didn't know. I mean, not having known barely anything about Buster Keaton before this, I didn't realize he had extreme hearing loss. So all of the press conferences, he always has a publicist around, and he just seems to just repeat the same phrases over and over again, and they just yank him out of there when he looks too frazzled to deal with press.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Well, a silent film star, you know, just is like truly, not all of them, but they're hobbled if they, I mean, again, how do you equate him talking like that with, you know, this character he created, you know, who's like lithe and graceful and, I mean, it basically isn't supposed to talk, like is a silent creation, you know, like a pantomime.
Well, to go back to his early years, for one, he basically gets hired by Fatty Arbuckle to like move. He's like a key grip and then works his way onto the set, you know, and then ends up like spinning off on his own thing, becoming a huge star, making $200,000 a year in 1927.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so millions.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. That's insane.
And then it's over.
And they give him, they give him a studio for a while. Yeah. They give him Chaplin's old studio.
But it was sort of like at that time, wasn't it all like fake? It's like, it's all like, we gave you a studio. We think you're great. Here's the studio. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We own the studio.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And everything you do.
Because he didn't take part in UA. That's like such an important part of his story, is that all of those amazing sound film stars and auteurs, like, was Mary Pickford part of UA? It was like Chaplin and they all went and formed it, and he stayed with the studio. And so when Silence were out, he was at the mercy of the studio, who had no use for him. You know?
Right. And he talks about Mayer a bit.
Does he?
Louis Mayer.
What does he say?
In the documentary, he says what a great actor he was because in meetings, he'd be like, oh no. You know, he would like have all these like theatrical moments and stuff he would do in the office with people. And he said, especially around women, Louis B. Mayer. I didn't know that about the United Artists thing. That's really interesting because I know that was Chaplin's baby. Yeah. And I do like.
And he was one of the silents who really made that transition.
Absolutely.
Even if it was only for, you know, maybe a 10-year period of time where it was really hitting, you know, like.
Yeah.
But just for The Great Dictator, Mr. Verdú, you know, like those are. Those are solid.
Yeah.
Didn't he make that one Lumiere? That's like, I think he did another one that was, you know, important. Anyway.
Yeah,
What were you saying about?
Well, I was saying that at one point, to put it kind of in perspective with the Fatty Arbuckle stuff, is that Charlie Chaplin moved his studios up to Marin.
Or Fremont or something?
Fremont, Marin area. Mm-hmm. And then United Artists was supposed to be in Northern California.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then because
like the tech industry.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they were disrupted.
It was the tech.
Well, it was just this whole area was just orange groves and weird laws. They had so many weird laws in L.A. County at the time that they moved north.
Apparently, a lot of Buster Keaton liked shooting in Truckee, which is near Lake Tahoe. I didn't.
What does it look like?
It's
over
just
there?
Like a all the train stuff. I think
he liked trains. He was very mechanical.
Do you think that's he seems in the movie very mechanical? He actually seems like to have like borderline. I mean,
Asperger's.
Something's going on.
Yeah,
I don't know what's going on, but it's a borderline. You know, I mean, alcoholism. If that's how you're medicating yourself for like. Mm-hmm. 20 years or whatever, or your whole life. You know, then probably by the time you're like 69.
70 is so young. I didn't realize he was that young.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's pretty young.
When he died?
Yeah.
He died at, I think he was 71, right?
Yeah, 71. It was like maybe 2 years after
the
shot. Yeah,
because he's 69 in the movie. Mm-hmm. It is young.
Yeah. And he's still like, he seems like his mind is always working, right? His mind is always like trying to figure out a guy. I feel like the other tension watching this is his tension with the British director, Poddington. And does also, like, it feels to me like it was just like, hey, we're going to use this old silent film star and make a promotional video about the beautiful glory of Canada. Especially, like, I watched the beginning of Railroad. I watched all of Railroader pretty much, but it was a little hard.
Fun. I mean, it's it, like, it's just like a thing.
Yeah.
It's like the, you would play it at the world's worst party, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's also like a thing, like, I remember, like, in the 60s, like, Amtrak was like using Johnny Cash to promote like trains. Yeah. People were just trying to promote train
but
travel.
But there's
I think,
an
too.
Element of this the Railroader that's sad because it's just like Canada is so behind the times that they're like literally using a silent film star to like advertise this glorious, incredible thing that doesn't you know, like
the train. Take the train across
but then
Canada.
They also use like the crappiest element of that, which is that two-man pumping.
Yeah, that thing. Tiny train, yeah.
In case you're listening, The Railroader is a short film that's what he was making. In it, and he's on one of those pumping things just going across Canada.
And Nick, you pointed out that like The Railroader's in color, but then this is in black and white, so this actually feels more in tradition with like the history of Buster Keaton. And
that's
when you look at the color, it just looks like 60s washed out color.
Mean, it's The Railroader is not...
not the finest Buster Keaton you're going to see.
No, but it's certainly a curiosity, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's another aspect of the documentary that was really interesting to me was, like, it really represents this element of Canada that's any nation that isn't the U.S., because the U.S. is where it stems, has this almost an over-reverence, you could say. But I don't think, in the case of Buster Keaton, I think that it's... deserved for him to be, you know, given what
the key to whatever that's,
you know, he's the mayor of Woodland Hills. That's another thing you learn.
Yeah.
Holy shit, that's right.
Watching that documentary that he's the honor. But, you know, Canada has been carpetbagged a million times by American acts. They come in, they're what the people are interested in. It's harder. It's like any local locality in America where the local scene in San Francisco would probably be annoyed that, like, you know, there's not enough people supporting their bands or their comedians.
Oh, yeah.
And then if people come out to see, you know, I don't know,
something
at Sketchfest, like all these guys who came in from like 2 hours away, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And Toronto has that in droves, you know, where it's like we have this JFL, we have all these festivals and all these, we have all these things where people kind of gather around Americans like worshipfully, and that's definitely what, you know, what the Railroader in the Buster Keaton documentary is like Canadians being like, we
There's
have no star system. We have no culture. In 1963, there's so little of it.
Right.
You know? Yeah, exactly. At that time, it really is like...
It's pre-Shatner.
Well, we've got this guy, Shatner, and we've got Michaels and
Esperanto,
Pomerantz, you know, who are like, you know...
Oh, Lorne Michaels.
And we've, you know, maybe not even at that time.
Just Toronto.
About that time.
And Toronto's probably like the biggest entertainment center city... Right, in Canada?
Well, I mean, an interesting thing about that time period was, you know, Toronto was just starting to be a major urban center and an art center. Montreal was possibly a more vibrant cultural place culturally at that at that time.
What year did Second City in Toronto start?
I would say I don't want to. I would say it would have been the late 60s to the early 70s. I don't remember whether it started because of Godspell happening in Toronto or whether it happened at the same, because the Second City in Toronto had all these people. It had like swaps with the Chicago Second City, and that was how you wound up having Harold Ramis and and you know, I'm trying to think of early some people are
Gilda?
American.
Andrew Martin.
Martin's American, you know. Joe Flaherty's American, you know, like they're, and so they would come. Gilda Radner as well. She was in Godspell. And so that was how you had that cross promotion. So I don't know when it started exactly, but it really started being the Second City as we knew it, like in the early 70s. So that wasn't happening. Like in, there was Wayne and Schuster, which was actually like a pretty good comedy show. If you watch it, it's like better than Laugh-In, basically. It's like smarter than Laugh-In. But it's just this classic Canadian thing of like slightly cornier, slightly smarter. You know, than your average American success at the equivalent. You know? But also, there's only one. I mean, and I'm I'm generalizing with Canadian comedy. I mean, obviously, you know, Kids in the Hall and SCTV are like, I think, as good as big comedy series get.
Yeah, and you can't do that on television.
I love You Can't Do That on Television.
That's right up there with.
But I feel like that was also had a vague CoPro feel, didn't it? Like you guys all watched it here.
Yeah.
It had, wasn't Ruth Buzzy on it?
Yeah, I think so.
And that really, really, like, the comedic, the older actors on You Can't Do That on Television are great. That guy who played Shat Barf or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, Super Dave was a Canadian production. And, I mean, it keeps going. But yeah, Canada had so little. So they're like, we can only get. And then, not only that, they could only find like a guy who was like playing, you know, county fair vaudeville shows in Calgary or whatever. As their person.
He's been insisting for the last 3 or 4 years that he is at least partially retired and intends to retire completely until the phone rings. But then he'll turn right around and tell somebody he's retiring. It wouldn't work out. Because if the phone didn't ring for a month, he would feel terribly neglected and abused because nobody wanted him anymore. Nobody loved him anymore. Nobody wanted him to work anymore. But deep down, I know darn well that he enjoys working or he wouldn't say yes.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I was thinking watching this about, actually not even watching this, going back and looking at like the classic Buster Keaton, just like a clip of like the best stuff from Buster Keaton. I was thinking about like the early Vine days, how people were just making, and it gets Vine kind of just popped, and then I feel like it's kind of not as interesting anymore.
Vine is awesome. I think it's awesome. But what to me Vine primarily functions as now is this thing where they like loop a chill sample over some footage. like it's just music over some pleasant footage and for 10 seconds or 11 seconds.
But you remember like the early Vine things that were just like people totally messing with the format and doing physical comedy.
I wrote for this show, Odd Squad, which was like a kids live action show. And
This is in Toronto?
In Toronto. Uh-huh. It's a co-production. It's it's a PBS show. Mm-hmm. It's won an Emmy for writing.
All right. Well, congratulations. All right. Congrats.
So I need, I'll take work.
Yeah, yeah. Odd Squad. Yeah, but, people are hiring off this podcast.
Yes. Sure. Oh, yeah. We have launched careers.
We got William Hudson a professorship. No, we didn't.
That's good. But when they had the season two meetup, they were like, we want to do special effects stuff. And they were like, we'd like it to be like a lot of this stuff this guy's doing on Vine. Mm-hmm. You know, because Vine is exactly what you were just talking about. You can do these trick photography things and be very, if you're amazing at editing, I guess you can really line it up and make it look crazy. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And it is a bit like that. Mm-hmm. You know? But do you have a Vine account?
I had one. And I don't do anything on it anymore. I just remember, like, is it Adam Goldberg that was doing all the crazy looping stuff? And, like, there were people that were doing a lot of, like, the basic kind of like going back to just physical comedy because there's not enough time to set up a verbal joke, right? That's the thing about Vine I thought was interesting. And I was like thinking about that. Like, I don't know who else has been doing crazy physical comedy in the last few years. You know, if there's been a wave back to physical comedy at all.
Let me think of things.
Josh Fadem, I guess, would be
he's
one
just always been doing
it. He's always been doing it. Yeah, it's not like. But he is a guy who reminds me of that old school style, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly
he has a very
needed,
theatrical. Yeah, you know, I agree.
It's such an odd time for comedy right now. Yeah. You can't even get into it. But let's just say, I think it's a dead form.
Right.
I think it's over. I think now it just is about, it's become sort of debate.
Yeah,
like just this sort of like large scale debaters club.
People bring in like that little case and the 3x5 cards on the podium.
Exactly.
The pros and cons.
Actually, in Canada, there's a very popular show, or I don't know if it's very popular, but it exists and it will probably never be canceled. It's called The Debaters, and it's just comedians debating with each other. And that was like was it Greg Giraldo show?
Okay, yeah, Lewis they did Black? It like a judge show. Yeah,
oh yeah,
with Giraldo. That's right. I remember that.
R.I.P.
Yep. Rip everything. That dude.
R.I.G.
So do you, but like watching old like silent film stuff. It's pretty transcendent. Like I feel like anyone could see this stuff and still enjoy it. But yeah, if like no one's making new shit. I don't feel like, or you just make animation, I guess, if you want to do straight up cartoon.
Vine's
gags.
Got, you know, Vine still has, like I said, like this sort of, it seems to have, I've seen a lot of stuff like that. And yeah, cartoon stuff is a big part of it. You could be doing it, but no one's doing cartoons. I don't really know what the problem is. It's something where there's like, your movies either have no budget, so it's just people interacting, like conversation.
Webisode, yeah.
Or they're so high budget that you actually can't risk anything. Mm-hmm. So they need to have set pieces so large that they're not really based on humans having to do that much. Mm-hmm. Or it's also like actors who aren't particularly graceful doing their own stunts so for the story. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like Tom Cruise is
right.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah,
like
he's doing
that. Just
a
person jumping off a thing, you know, it's cool, but it's like, that doesn't necessarily feed into anything. I'm trying to think of any movie I've seen like that that has, like, you know, Game of Thrones has stuff. TV has some stuff still. Mm-hmm. I think TV is where you'd find it probably, but I can't even be bothered.
Yeah.
I only watch Game of Thrones.
It's the only thing you watch.
Well, I mean, comedy has kind of moved towards this interpersonal material now where, like, you watch any comedy on Netflix that's a series or even movies, it's about guys and girls and
editing is the other side of it. Like the Tim and Eric kind of thing, which is, like, all in the editing room or Steve Brule or, you know.
Yeah.
Because, like, the Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, all those guys, it's, like, these broad situations with lots of gags and physical comedy, which is great because it's syncopated and it's musical and it has a rhythm to it. And that kind of stuff's a little lost now. You know, we don't have that broad syncopation, you know. You have this kind of narrowly focused
stuff.
Thinking,
like, how I think, like, even, like, a show, like, I watched a show, you know, Black Books. Like, I was watching that show, which is like a British sitcom, and then like there's so much goofy slapsticky stuff in it. I'm like, I kind of forgot how it's like dumb, but it's smart at the same time.
Yeah, uh-huh. Like, British comedies do sort of have an element of
Blackadder.
Blackadder. Well, I mean, if you're going into that, you know, John Cleese and like Monty Python in general, and then definitely Mr. Bean and Rowan Atkinson and like,
Benny Hill,
you know, Michael Richards. Mm. But we're talking about that's a different generation. Like I think that even in that period of time, you would have people who were very good movement wise would be hired in a movie that was like, actually, you know, Chris Farley was very physically proficient.
I thought of him too. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Phil Hartman didn't really get to exercise that much, but you always got a sense of his physicality as a performer. I think it's just that, you know, there was such a move towards naturalism, I think, with like a side of comedy, like the Judd Apatow movies.
All the Judd Apatow stuff.
And then, you know, Kristen Wiig's, like, it's not the same. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, that school of comedy seems like it's more about character. Yeah. Like, I don't even think of Will Ferrell completely as a physical comedian.
Yeah. Well, when I think of, like, what's going on with Buster Keaton and the thing that he brings up in the doc, right? Him and the British director Poddington are kind of having this fight over like one stunt, and like basically Buster Keaton wants to amp it up and actually make it dangerous. He's like, there's nothing funny about me being on a train track unless there's a chance I'm going to collide with something. And he's just like, it's just a basic principle, and they're just like kind of like pussyfooting around it. And so like that's a lot of his stuff is just, it's so like thrilling. It's just thrills.
That's it. It's thrills. Yeah. But it makes you just wonder if there's so much offered nowadays. At that time, you know, there was like, you went to the comedy show and you went to the movies and you were like, I hope there's chills, spills, and laughter.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. It's like
a
now
good
it's
piano.
Like, it's
I hope the pianist knows what he's doing or else we're screwed.
It's like I could watch something on the big screen, and like I'll watch Ghostbusters, I'll assume there's like a green screen and some foam pads, or I could watch a YouTube video of a guy standing on a ladder and a car coming towards him, and he jumps off the ladder in time to land on the ground and not get hit by the car. Like, that's maybe where that direction went. That's what I was thinking with the Vine thought, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's where that kind of like, or like bum fights or
whatever.
Well, I
mean, you could really only, the only thing you can compare it to that sort of stuff besides, like, I've harped on like Jackie Chan movies and stuff. But I really do think that he worshipped those performers. So he's would be maybe the
Hong
Jackass
Kong,
people.
Oh,
would be the other side of that.
That's true.
Except those guys never were trying to do it with like grace.
Right.
You know, that would be the
one. Or pathos.
And they were also, they kind of inverted it because they were like, I want it to hit me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to survive the trauma.
Yeah.
Or you know? Not.
Yeah.
Well, you don't
in
really.
The case of
they're not looking for you to feel bad about them, you know?
Right. And I feel like.
They want you to laugh at the bad life decision.
Yeah.
Which is not the same.
No.
But there is an element. There is an element to the best stuff in Jackass, I think, that's like a little bit like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then Sacha Baron Cohen has his own kind of element to
that. Yeah, that's close to it. Yeah, that's, you're getting into the British stuff.
Yeah.
That's closer to it, I think. Mm-hmm. You know?
I see that, yeah.
I almost feel like in American culture, comedians are no longer the nerdy outcast anymore, in a sense. I feel like comics are kind of the cool people now.
Right.
I guess maybe it's like the trope for so long was that the nerdy outcast actually is cool.
Yeah,
right.
That now it's just like everybody knows that's the case.
Yeah.
It's like everyone's like, we're all like this, right?
Right. Yeah, that's all cool.
I remember we're all schlubs, but we all like to have sex.
The whole Seth Rogen genre.
Canadian.
Oh, yeah.
Someone was pointing, I think it was a Slate Culture podcast, which I listen to sometime, they're talking about how like Ghostbusters meant something completely different in the 80s because generationally it was like clear like the idea of the comedy nerd and the rebel kind of being the outside force, whereas now it is completely like, yeah, the mainstream.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Revenge of the Nerds was so big because the nerds got their revenge, which you never saw.
There were a couple. I mean, Ted McGinley, you know, I put him in a movie. It's gold. Yeah. Box office gold immediately.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I definitely think that that's true, although I still think at that time, those movies were... They were big because the nerd actually was a lot closer to, like, the geek. Like, the classic sideshow geek.
Yeah.
Like, who is this freak? Let's laugh at these freaks. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Like, Revenge of the Nerds 2 was like, oh, this... And I think that there was a subtle kind of, like, these are the heroes kind of view of them. But I do think that the mainstream view of that would be, like... Let's go watch Revenge of the Nerds. Look at these disgusting people winning.
But they won. The difference is they win. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Porky's. They all win.
But they're not nerds in Porky's.
They're nerdy.
Two of them are. Yeah. Aren't they just kind of like...
I mean, Booger was...
Booger's nerds.
Yeah.
He's nerds. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Porky's, yeah, yeah. Porky's is just guys.
Is there any stars out of Porky's, actually?
Was Kim Cattrall in Porky's?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that would be I remember just seeing that poster and being like, so like, what is happening?
Yeah. There's actually a podcast called The Imposter.
Things just moved.
There's a podcast called The Imposter out of Canada that's made by the Canada Land people, and they had a pretty good piece about the tax shelter movies in Canada, which Porky's actually ruined that by being a success.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And that produced some of the world's most confusing sex comedy, 80s sex comedies.
It was
Canadian
just
tax
loopholes
stuff? Yeah, so Screwballs, Canadian. Recruits is Canadian. You know, Cannibal Girls, which is Ivan Reitman's very early movie with Andrew Martin and Eugene Levy. Uh-huh. That was a tax shelter movie. A lot of early Cronenberg was.
Wow.
Cronenberg, too. Okay.
Yeah, well, because, you know, his ideas still feel like they barely hold together.
Right.
Actually, speaking of Reitman, I know this guy Poddington, who made Railroader, had worked on Heavy Metal, and that was... Through Ivan Reitman.
Worked on Heavy Metal.
Yeah, he was technically the director
like a tax
of Heavy
shelter
Metal
too, doesn't it? That
Heavy
movie
Metal is not a good movie. Yeah. Yeah.
The '80s was like the movies that worked, like Ghostbusters or whatever, they were also very. I feel like they were always referencing either the past or like New York City. You know,
yeah.
Like,
there's a lot of New York City.
Yeah, I hate to say like that. You know, it's a character in the film, but the '80s was all about trying to make New York City a place. You wanted to go because apparently it was a place you wouldn't actually have wanted to go to.
The Tourism Board of New York City gave money to
almost all those types, like Working Girl probably. Because
at the end in the credits, it always like, and thanks to the Travel Board of New York City.
Toronto always doubles as New York, I feel like, in a lot of things.
Yeah, less so, maybe not less so, but just like it's short circuit too. That's the important one. Police Academy.
And
that's the important
one. Always helped to have Bill Murray as your king of the nerd too.
Yeah.
To like move that a vehicle.
But comedy now is like it doesn't feel as referential to a past, particularly to me, you know, like it's all about we're just these crumb bums living in the now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and
it's very slacker oriented. One of my favorite things about this doc too is the like you just don't doubt Buster Keaton on a gag. You know,
yeah,
like,
you can't really argue with him.
No,
this foppish British dude, or this. Yeah. Oh, I tell you, I've been. Like, it's like a carny. He's like a carny.
He is literally a carny.
Like, he was like, he had been doing. By the time he's 21, he's like, I'm a veteran of this shit.
Yeah.
Were there any good comedies made in the 1960s?
Well, that's a good
question.
It's
a mad.
No, that's not good. Probably
depends on your definition.
Yeah, exactly. I'm talking about. There's probably a lot of good
dark comedy.
Yeah, like Doctor Strangelove, which
is what the first
barely
thing I thought of.
Like is
it's
that
not
a comedy?
It's not really. No.
It's a well-made film that is great to fall asleep.
The Apartment.
Yeah. I never saw it.
That's great.
Yeah.
The Billy Wilder stuff. Like,
yeah. No, you know. I mean, I'm definitely not trying to say there were no good comedies, but I'm trying to have us figure out what constitute because
in
it's
the 60s
I think there were a lot of those mad world kind of movies and I think those were probably bad
are not good.
I think that
they're very
so that then dips into the
Cannonball
Peter
Run
Sellers movies, which I think the Cannonball Run is like the 80s.
Yeah, it's like late
Peter Sellers movies.
Peter Sellers, yeah. Pink
they're
Panther.
Probably not good.
I Yeah.
I think the first one on the trail of the Pink Panther.
I remember.
Yeah,
I
mean, they're pretty racist.
I bet that the first one's okay, but I bet there's a lot of sleeping. Like, my question is, how much are you sleeping during these films? You know? So then the party, that's definitely a 60s movie, but can anyone watch The Party anymore? That was
no.
The movie that, like, 15 years ago, everyone's like, it's the greatest movie ever. Now you just watch it, and it's like, it's him saying Birdie Num Nums. I mean, he is an amazing performer. There's an element of...
Yeah, I know The Party.
The Party?
Yeah.
The Party was that movie that was... I mean, to me, it would be the go-to movie that your parents or your dads, like, in... would go, oh, have you not seen it? And, like, guys in the 60s, you know, hippies in the 60s are seeing it. It was Peter Sellers as an Indian guy. You don't remember this movie? Yeah.
No, I never saw
this. And he's like... Birdie Num Nums. Oh, everybody would talk, and that was it's hysterical.
Brown face, early brown face. Yeah,
yeah, but was he?
It's what Mike Myers based.
His Love Guru thing on?
And it's why, you know, movies like that are why comedians are not afraid to do that kind of thing, because they think, you know, that basically I feel like a comedian's whole deal is like, if I can get away with him, if I can embody this somehow, I'm actually not being racist. You know?
Right, yeah.
Like, of course, when you're British, you know, when you're a British person, you're like, if I can embody this colonial creation, I got it. Gets really.
I do have to see this now that we're talking
about it. It's so bad.
It's also not just bad because of the fact he's playing an Indian guy, although that's a massive problem with it, obviously.
Yeah.
It's the fact that, like, there's just it's just boring.
but the earliest Woody Allen movies are good. They kind of hold up. What up, Tiger?
Those are 60s.
What's up, Tiger?
I mean, aren't they such degraded film quality that you can barely see what's happening?
Well, I mean, we can split. We
and also,
can
Take
nitpick.
The Money and Run is not that good anymore.
It's like, pretty good.
I don't know. I watched that and I was like...
So what's your favorite decade for comedy then?
That's an interesting question. Almost the 90s, just because of...
Maybe our generation.
It's just generationally. Yeah. It's like... But I don't know if I'm saying the 90s. What am I picking from the 90s?
Right.
Dirty Work?
Tommy Boy.
Tommy Boy.
Dirty Work's great.
Yeah, these are great movies.
Fargo?
For a generation.
Would that be...
Well, yeah, that's a problem. It's
Raising
like,
Arizona.
When you're talking about the 60s comedies, it's like, yeah, there's not maybe that many really good, like, slapstick comedies or, like, movies like Buster Keaton films, but there's probably a lot of interesting... darkly comic movies like Billy Liar. I don't know. You know, like just these movies that are like.
What Harold and Maude? When was that?
70s.
Oh,
that's 70s. That's early 70s.
Yeah.
I almost feel like now.
Brewster McCloud is 1968, but I don't want to see Brewster McCloud particularly.
Yeah.
I feel like now it would be like you'd make like a tragicomedy about the 69-year-old Buster Keaton. It's like the Neil Hamburger movie, basically.
Or
you know, like it's
just
a sad, broken
Shadow
down
of the Vampire,
entertainer.
Or whatever it was
called. Oh, like, with the Amirnau? Is that the one?
I think
Defoe
that one created, you know, helped at least update some sort of a genre, which was like, you know, I was remember 20 years ago when Elvis Meets Nixon came out? Like the movie Elvis Meets Nixon came out?
No, I never saw that.
And then they made a real... like high budget version of that now, where it's like 20 years ago they made a movie called Elvis Meets Nixon. It was low budget, trauma style movie.
Okay.
And now they did it with, like, I don't remember who's playing Elvis, but it's like, you know, Paul Giamatti or somebody. You know?
Yeah.
You can do anything.
It's Jack Black.
It's Jack Black. Or you. So
Jack Black would be a good Elvis.
He would be a good older
Elvis.
Shadow of the Vampire is interesting because it's so fictionalized that it becomes fantasy. You know. And I think that there was something, I thought that was a cool movie, but I didn't, it just didn't feel quite artful enough for me.
I feel like documentaries are the best unintended comedies we have.
Yeah, I think in this era, but it's also been kind of, it's all been mined so hard, you know, that, like, I agree with you. I think when it came out, American Movie was viewed as like a comedy film on level of something else. And then I always thought that, in storytelling, you want to talk about a comedian, a comedy filmmaker. Todd Solondz is one of the last comedic auteurs.
Oh, let's talk about Wiener Dog.
You know, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, man, we got to see that.
But I've seen all of his other movies. I've never not seen a Todd Solondz movie because you actually have to actively support that.
Yeah.
Because it's a guy who writes his movies and directs them, and there's style. All I want is a tinge of
give me a little
style.
Taste of style.
And I'm like, like a consistency of style.
What do you think of Bobcats movies?
Oh my God, I was so pleasantly surprised when I finally saw. I didn't see any of his movies for years. I just sort of respected him. You know, Shakes the Clown when I was a kid, I thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And I respected he was working so much and it shifted so much. But it was not the first one I ever saw. It might still be the only one I've seen. No, I'll get into his documentary in a second.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But Man of God Bless America.
Yeah, right. God Bless
America.
I saw that and I was just like, wow, this is like really what I want. A guy who wrote a script that's pointed and then directed it in the way he wants. I was just so impressed and so happy that he's out there doing it. And then I saw Call Me Lucky, and I was like...
You haven't seen Father of the Year?
No, that was like the one that kind of got me wanting... It's just all of his movies, before I saw them, felt like they had such like shocking content.
Yeah, like
I thought they seemed
high concept,
like
gimmicky.
They would not... They'd be something... And then when I saw God Bless America, I was like, well, he's so intelligent and savvy and capable that, you know, it's really worthwhile that he's done. He's working. It's so great. You know?
And Call Me Lucky is incredible.
Have you seen that one?
I haven't. I know. It's on the list. I was like thinking we're going to do that with him.
That's like the best thing he'll ever
point.
Do, probably, just it's, because of...
Uh-huh. We're trying to either talk to Barry Crimmins or Bobcat, which I would love either one, because Barry Crimmins, when I was a kid, was one of my favorite stand-up comics.
Yeah.
I used to tape his Showtime.
Are you also from the Bay Area?
No, I'm from Michigan.
Okay.
I'm from Lower Canada.
Yeah, Lower Canada.
And
Windsor Senior.
Yeah. We used to go to Windsor all the time, to the Windsor Ballet. When we were in college, we liked to call it.
Sounds fancy.
It was strip club.
Yeah. Okay.
But Barry, I loved Barry Crimmins, and I was really excited to see this doc, and it's so moving.
Well,
and
it's interesting for so many reasons, because it's like you see a movie like When Stand Up Stood Out, or not? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
And that's this documentary about the Boston scene.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
The Boston scene being pivotal to current American comedy scene, primarily because it was really the establishment of, like, we're going to pay you for, like, every single spot you do. And we're going to pay you more and more. So it was really the only time where...
$400 bucks to host.
You know, and it's not... It's not one of the big
Christ.
American cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's one of the big ones, but it's not, like, one of the humongous metropolises like New York, L.A.,
Chicago.
And people were bringing in like $100,000 a year. Like they were really making a ton
working
of money.
Working comics in Boston.
5 days a week, three sets a night in comedy. And Barry Crimmins was actually one of the people who made that possible.
Yeah.
So
Is Ron Lynch in that doc too?
I don't think he's in the documentary, but that was the scene that
scene.
He was in. And, you know, Boston remains an incredibly vibrant city like so many American cities but for comedy. But you see that and you get this one side of him, and then you see this other movie and Call Me Lucky, and it's just like it's like got almost that Mr. Death quality of in the middle it sort of spins this other way or tickled if you've seen Tickled.
We haven't done that yet. Did you see it in theater?
I saw it in the theater. I saw Call Me Lucky at the Sundance premiere. I saw Barry Crimmins watch it for the first time.
Whoa. Very cool.
Yeah, that was like really
that's
intense.
Heavy.
Yeah.
But I have not seen Tickled. I really want to.
Tickled's
let's make an outing. Let's just do an outing. You should come with us.
Yeah.
You already saw it. See it again.
I fucking saw it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I thought it was good, but I'm just I feel like I'm a junkie who just always wants new things.
Yeah.
So, like, even, like, now this type of documentary that takes that spin or chases after a weird person. Now I view that as some kind of a trope, which is on me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's
what
like...
What was your number two pick if we weren't able to do this? What else?
If you guys had said, well, it's under an hour, so we're not going to do it. Or if you said, you know...
We know we don't take that stance
on it. Post-1970s.
Yeah.
Well, there's so many good documentaries. You
said something about Sunset. Is that the Mayor of the Sunset Strip, the Bingenheimer movie? Or
oh, well, that one's Sunset? Actually like a Netflix one that's kind of bad.
Sunset?
It's one of these. It's called Sunset Strip. I think it's just called Sunset Strip. It's actually pretty bad. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with like Netflix's.
They're cranking out all
this. Like just the shit that they're carrying. Yeah. And so Sunset Strip is like a documentary that has some really good interview subjects. Some really good stories in it, but it's literally trying to cover the story of the Sunset Strip in like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It's like when you watch Sonic Highways. You know, like Sonic Highways is like this really unsatisfying documentary in my mind.
Yeah.
Because every episode is like touching on all this shit you care about.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's over.
And then it's a Foo Fighters song.
And then it's a horrible Foo Fighters song.
I've only seen the Albini one, so that's...
The Albini kind of, one, you know, has all this great stuff with Steve Albini, who's so rarely covered. Yeah. And but it just touches for a half... It shows a half second
it's,
of, like, some band. And it's like, why isn't there just a document... Why didn't they just commission entire documentaries? Why didn't they just make these two-hour-long things, you know? So Sunset Strip is like... One minute they're talking about like Mickey Cohen, and then suddenly they're interviewing like Slash, then they're interviewing like Rodney Bingamine. Then, you know, there's like archival footage of like all these LA things. If there's ever like an archival footage thing of people going into the lot, you're like, you just wasted time. Everybody has seen this shit.
Yeah.
You don't
or Angeline or something.
Yeah. Just skipped like the 80s. I skipped my ride along with Angeline. Yeah. I was going to do, I won a ride along with Angeline.
Whoa.
And I skipped it.
Oh.
How did you win that?
She went into my lady friend's store and left a raffle thing. And you could put your name in it. And I was one of two people who put their name in it.
Wow.
And I got a phone call. Tomorrow, go to the Hollywood Coffee Bean, you know, and you'll meet up with her. And they were trying to do it as soon as possible.
Yeah.
That was like the first thing I noticed was like he called me on like a Friday, and he's like, well, you want to go for the ride with her on Sunday? And I was like, well, that seems nice. It's like a Sunday ride along with Angeline. Everyone will be waving at you like they do in the Los Angeles we've all created in our mind.
Yeah.
That Angeline is like, and then the next, then I wrote on Facebook that this was happening, and all of these people who you would know started posting,
like
Kevin Kataoka, who I just met.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote, who seems really cool. He wrote, like, she will try to take all of, get ready to, like, be hit up for, like, tons of money.
Oh,
and then Corey Sklar wrote in,
Corey Sklar,
in big letters, he wrote, like, she will try to get you to buy her food.
Uh-huh.
And then I read, first I read an LA Weekly article about a ride along that was, like, the subtext of it was that she was pretty desperate for money. Oh. And then there's this long article about a guy who did the ride along.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And it was so detailed that it made me think you don't actually need another article like this.
Yeah.
And it made me go, I don't think I can do it. Yeah. I'm such a soft touch. I'm so, I have no identity.
That's amazing.
If you ask me for, I'll probably give you money if I have it and I don't have any.
Angeline rides again.
So I was postponed it and I haven't gotten back in touch yet.
Oh my gosh.
So. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. I mean, not unfortunately, but this was great. Thank you. We're going to leave it there.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks for joining us on this and talking about Buster Keaton Rides Again.
Did I talk enough about it?
Yes. We covered quite a bit. It was great. If you want, tell people where they can find you.
Okay. I'm at the Flans on Twitter. This is like such a long, going to be a really long list.
Because, that's fine.
You know, there's 18 different means of social media now.
Right.
First of all, find out about everything on www.theflans.com. T-H-E-F-L-A-N-S. And then at the Flans is my Twitter. Nick Flanagan's my Instagram. I'm, what is it? F-L-A-N... I'm D-A-F... Dufflands on Snapchat. D-A-F-L-A-N-Z.
Nice.
Instagram, Nick Flanagan.
Vine.
Vine, Nick Flanagan.
Branding.
Tumblr.
And you got a new album you're going to be
Dropping new album called Wiped Privilege. You can buy it on tape with the download code pretty soon. And I have an album called I'm Here All Week that you can order right now. Buy it on vinyl at classicbarmusic.com. I do a monthly show in LA, rough semi-monthly. It's called Night Comedy in our gallery called Night Comedy.
Very cool. Thank you, buddy. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please subscribe, review, and rate.
For show notes or more information about George and Paco's appearances, visit supdocpodcast.com. You can send your corrections, questions, or comments to supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
We'd also like to thank Documentary News for their continued support. Please check out documentarynews.com.
Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @supdocpodcast.
This show is produced by Will Scovel and our theme music by David Siegel.